tactic. At least it says we are willing to listen. We're willing to be criticized, whether people are right or wrong. I mean, we're public figures. And we understand that that goes with the territory, and this is how this country came into being and what makes it great. This really can win you some solid public support in a disagreement where you may or may not have the support of the majority of the people in your district. But they will respect the way you're handling it, and often, as you know, the way you're handling it is more important than your position on the issue. The fifth kind is really the most important of all, because this is where 90% of all the issues and crises come from. I'm going to draw a big circle around it, and that's operational failure. Something happens that wasn't supposed to happen. We screwed up. Something went wrong. The system didn't work the way it was supposed to. We didn't have a system where we should have had one. Literally, 90% of all the issues, if you chart them back to 39 the way NORC did, if I look at our own practice and our own files, 90% of the issues are right here. Something that happened in the system. Now, clearly, as administrators, if things were perfect, we ought to be able to handle that and see that there aren't these operational failures. But humans being humans, we know that some are going to get through. What do you do when you have this most common kind of a situation? The first step is to acknowledge that this has occurred. And if it's really a screw-up and you know that there's no getting around it, as quickly as you can, say, look, we goofed. We goofed. For a public figure to say, I goofed, is perhaps those are the two most powerful words in American public life. People respect someone who's willing to say, hey, I'm human just like you, and we didn't do it right. But that isn't enough. Then you have to follow that with expressing regret. You know, we screwed up. We're certainly, you know, very, very sorry that this happened. And detail your plans to resolve it. Does it work? Well, I don't know. Look at old Lee Iacocca. Look at old Lee Iacocca. He's taking those Chryslers, and he and some of his fellow managers are driving them for 4,000 or 5,000 miles to test them out, and then they're selling them to you and me with the odometers turned back and a few little things like that. How did Iacocca get out of that one? Why did it only last 2 days? It only lasted 2 days because on the second day, he ran full-page ads all over America and went on all three television networks to say, hey, you know what? I screwed up. That was the dumbest thing he says I can imagine. Chrysler, my company, doing something stupid like that. That's just the way he said it. And everybody gathered around the tube said, that's my Lee, baby. I knew he wouldn't let this go on. See? And it died. It disappeared. Chrysler didn't even feel a ripple in their sales. In fact, their public relations vice president tells me that it really kind of got their name out in front of a lot of people for a couple of days. In a big way, they dominated the news. You know, it's tough to get a brand name out there for 2 days like that. So if anything, they may have benefited from it because they knew how to handle it. Well, if some of that sounds familiar to you, so be it. Now let's take a look at some of the methods that will enable you really to put some kind of a system into place. In fact, I said methods. That's really not an accurate term anymore, because those of us dealing with this subject have determined that there is today one and only one effective way to anticipate issues, to deal with them before they start, and here's what it is. It's to set up in your organization an issue anticipation team or teams. And let me tell you why we have dropped all the other methods. When we first began talking about dealing with issues about 15 years ago, the idea was that maybe those of us who are professionals would do this job. It would just kind of be added to our portfolio. And it didn't work very well. And the reason it didn't work very well is because no one person or even one department which is focused on a task can really do the job. And so we got out of it. Well, then a lot of organizations began hiring what they called strategic planners, or they began hiring these futurists to look at the issues. And what they found was that while some alligator was biting their ankle, these people were always looking off again at 2018, you know, what's going to happen? So we canned that method. Well, the telephone company, probably the most screwed up organization in the universe right now. Well, if you don't agree with it, I say this with all humility, because we counseled all the telephone companies east of the Mississippi, including yours. If you don't think they're the most screwed up, let me ask you a couple questions. Anybody here who really understands the new telephone system, please raise your hand. See what I mean? Here you are, a public utility. Everybody has one or two, and nobody even knows how the system works. Given that extremely difficult situation, the telephone company, one specific telephone company, began setting up issue anticipation teams. Here's what they did. In their case, they have plural teams because they've got a lot of issues. They take a group of people in all levels of the organization. To apply this to schools, we would take maybe a janitor, a teacher, maybe an administrator, maybe teachers from different parts of the system, maybe a parent, possibly even a senior, a high school student. And these people meet on a fairly regular basis, and they have a very simple charter. Nothing fancy again, just very simple. And the charter is this: what's happening out there, and could it have an effect here? That's all. Just what's going on out there, and could it have an effect here? Now, these teams, or this team, when its research shows that maybe there's something cooking that we ought to pay some attention to, immediately then has access to the highest levels of management, or even maybe to the board. We have some clients where the board has an issue anticipation team, and they bring in a lot of people from the district and from the community to do this job. The reason that teams seem to be the answer is because, first of all, you and I might get together and we'd look at an issue and we'd see it in a certain way, but we wouldn't see it the way somebody who is at a staff level would, a support staff. We wouldn't see it maybe the way a first grade teacher or a ninth grade teacher or a principal in a certain type of school would. We would try, but you know, they live there. And so they can immediately see things that you or I might not. And if you put together a lot of people who view the world differently and whose daily work puts them in contact with different elements in the community, now you got a powerful tool for people who really get to understand what's going on out there. Now, how do they work? Oh, they're all the way from formal organizations that people are fighting to get on because it's a great honor, all the way down to brown bag lunch groups who meet. We have a lot of school systems where they meet maybe once a week, maybe every Thursday they brown bag it together. And usually the first thing they do is they either divide up their piece of the community in some kind of geographic area based on where they live or who they know, and they kind of keep their ear to the ground, you know, as to what am I hearing, what's going on out there. And then usually they'll take the news media, not only of the community, but also maybe of education or of the world, and they will sort of divide that up, and they'll read various things from time to time just to kind of get a feel for what's happening. And within 6 or 8 weeks, these people, two things happens to these people. First, boy, oh boy, are they ever great champions for education and for the schools. Because they see what's happening. They see that the school has put confidence in them to help deal with this. And ooh, you've got some real folks here. In industry, I'll tell you a secret. In industry, on issue anticipation teams, we pick the tired middle-level managers and we put them on the team, because we have never found anything to re-energize those people like this. Because now, by golly, I mean, this is critically important. They know that the real future of the system could indeed be in the hands of this committee if they can do their job well. Furthermore, they're dealing with other people in a true teamwork situation. And so the team, once it gets empowered, becomes a really good sponge to report back on what's happening. Now, that's all their job is. Keep your eyes and ears, your antennae out there, and then if you've got something that you think is hot, then their job is to really put together all the data they can get and run it up to administration at some level, usually pretty senior level, so that they know that their job is very, very important. Then they go back to looking for other issues as a rule, although in some school districts, if an issue looks like something they have to do something about, they may have a role that's really an administrative detail of what you assign to them after that. Now, in addition to the benefits that I've mentioned, really building teamwork among some important people because they're practicing it, taking some folks who may want to get more involved in what's really happening and giving them a chance to do that, building some champions. Despite all those benefits, you do have to watch out for certain things. One is that the people on this have to change with some regularity. It's like any other body, including school boards. If we don't get some new blood in there once in a while, they become myopic and they lose their ability. Now, in some districts where we work, we will have a team in certain geographic quadrants or sometimes a team for each school, which will look in that particular school's catchment area and find out what's really happening. If we do that, then we generally will have a team on the board or a team in the senior management, which will kind of look at the world of education all over the United States and say, you know, what's happening out there and could it happen here? The secret, though, I think, of why teams are an effective way of anticipating issues, in addition to the ones I've mentioned, is that really anticipating issues is kind of a covert phrase. Because what it really means is being willing ourselves as administrators to understand that change is permanent. And we're going to start managing our institutions for change almost on a daily basis. And this is one of the great first steps. I can't tell you how many districts, how many hospitals, corporations, and others are using this method. I can tell you that wherever I've been involved, it has worked. In fact, I have come lately to believe that teams of one kind or another are probably the wave of really running our schools in the next 10 years or so. We have school public relations teams, we have community relations teams, we have financial planning teams, but you know, what's working everywhere else? It's getting people throughout the system involved in the real issues so they feel empowered. I can tell you this much, if an issue slips through and becomes hot, and sometimes you just can't help it, and if a bedfellow situation or an accident occurs and suddenly we have a crisis, these people are just the most marvelous champions out in that community that you can imagine. Now, there's a further wrinkle on issue anticipation teams. And again, this one we cooked up with the telephone company. As a matter of fact, a sister company of your telephone company. This is done in an objective, hands-off fashion. The team may get out and listen, but I mean, that's just sort of an intuitive thing. It's happenstantial. So the question arises, couldn't we make this even more scientific, if you will, more trustworthy? Well, we can do that, and the system that is used for that is called by various names, one of which is constituency relations. Constituency relations occurs in organizations which may have an issue anticipation team looking at certain things. What constituency relations does is to pull together from the school district, or from the school or the system, a number of volunteers who are concerned about relationships in the community, which is where all these issues will, after all, arise, and they're concerned enough to volunteer a little bit of their time to become what we call key contact persons. A key contact person is assigned then, maybe in the course of a year, to keep up contacts with 4 or 6 identified opinion leaders in that community. Now, these may be people who are opinion leaders for the schools. It may be people who are opinion leaders against the schools or questioning the schools. But we get together a group of key contacts. We identify the opinion leaders. And by opinion leaders, I mean those people at all levels of society who really are in a position of having others pay attention to their opinions. And a couple of times a year, sometimes more often, but usually just a couple of times a year, the key contact person goes out and spends an hour or two just visiting with this opinion leader. They do a lot of listening. It's mostly listening. What are you hearing about the schools? Does your grandkid go here? What does he think? You know, what about your neighbors? What do you hear at work? What's on your mind? What have you been reading that you think might apply to our situation? And then they do a little sharing. What are our goals this year? What are the good things that are happening? And that's it, only with this difference. When each key contact person comes back, they simply punch into a very simple PC software the key points of what they learned. Now, if you've got 100 people, 10 people, depending on the size of your district, who are out there seeing a certain number of opinion leaders a couple of times a year in this very friendly, down-to-earth, social give-and-take fashion, and you're punching that into a computer system, you don't put any names with it. You don't have to put any names with it. There's no danger in this. You're just gathering data. What does the community want? What do our constituents feel about their relations with the schools? If you do that, now you've probably got the most powerful weapon for allowing the public to truly co-manage education, but without the way they usually try and manage it, namely a march on the board meeting and a lot of hoorah and fluff and crisis. Here, we get a very good feeling of where people are, what's really on their minds. And because they build a relationship with a key contact person, the exchange and the sharing there is good. Now, like any other system, it has to be managed. Sometimes a key contact says, you know, Susie and I really just don't hit it off. Well, fine, so we'll put John in your place. Sometimes opinion leaders kind of lose their opinion leadership. So you don't maybe want to bother seeing them anymore. You want to talk to somebody else. It happens. The world changes. But those are two methods that I can absolutely recommend to you to get this job done. This one may be more sophisticated than you want to deal with. But if I were in your situation, and if I was taking a look at the issues coming down the pike for education, I would sure want to have a system in place as soon as possible, if you don't already, to get ahead of those issues. My personal postulation of school issues for at least the next 3 to 5 years is really somewhat frightening to me even, and it is this. All of the major issues that I am currently dealing with for districts, or that we can see coming, all of them are tied one way or another to religion. And if there's ever an issue that's a loser, it's when religion is involved. But if you talk about textbooks, you talk about curriculum, you talk about homeschooling, name your issue, sex education, let's go down the list. We are reliving the 17th century. The question of free will versus divine right is really right here at the base of these issues if you look into them. And you know how it turned out in the 17th century. It wasn't too good for most people involved. So I think we have a real incentive to get ahead of the issues and see what we can do about them. The question that is often asked is, as administrators, how much of this really should we do? And how much of this is kind of, you know, socio-political? Isn't this the board's bailiwick? Well, each of you clearly has to answer that for yourselves in your own district. If you can get the board involved, I think that's wonderful. My current impression is, however, that most board members tend not to look, for obvious reasons, at issues very objectively. They tend to look at issues based on, what's it going to do to me? Am I going to be dragged through? Or whatever. So I think it's something that the administrative level can and should do. And it is being done. Well, one more word and then let's open it up to questions. Just to show you how important it is to know what's going on out there, to know what these issues are, and to know how people respond to them, let me tell you a little personal story. Gary Hart, remember him? Well, you know, people fade so fast in our society that I wasn't sure you did remember old Gary. When Gary had his little problem, he was in Berlin, New Hampshire, which is a lovely mill town up in the White Mountain National Forest, a couple hours north of us. And so his campaign people called us right away and said, what do we do now? And it was relatively easy, by the way. We gave him about six scenarios that would easily have dealt with his problem, and he could have gone right on campaigning. So we were a little disappointed the following Monday. It happened on a Friday. The following Monday, when he dropped out of the campaign. So one of the people in our firm called up and says, gee, you know, didn't you think you could pull off those strategies we gave you? And the answer was, well, the strategies you gave us were great. I mean, they really handled that one weekend. The trouble was, what were we going to do about next weekend and the weekend after that and then the next weekend? Well, we did some research based on that to see where are people. Where are people really today on things that you and I think we know concerning, in this case, public officials? It's pretty amazing. Let me share it with you. Somewhat acceptable kinds of scandal issues, if you will, if we can call that a scandal. I hate to dignify it with that, but if we can, whatever that was. I don't want to call it a bedfellow issue. I want to make that clear. But it's marital infidelity. No sweat. I mean, 3/4 of all Americans thought that was foolishness, the whole heart business, and that he deserved his privacy and the whole business. Interestingly enough, though we are absolutely down on drunk driving in society, drunk driving by public officials is expected. And it's expected also that they will get off while the rest of us get, you know, either that or really now zapped. Somewhat less acceptable is hospitalization for psychiatric illness. That awful situation with the vice presidential candidate, you remember, is still with us. This is not very acceptable to have been treated. I guess we still are puritanical about that. Cheating on income tax is a bad deal. People don't like that. Using drugs is a no-no. And homosexuality is still at the absolute bottom of the list, almost. And remember, Jim Baker was not dismissed by his church because of his relationships with a young lady. He was dismissed because another preacher in Tulsa claimed that at one time in his life he had had a homosexual relation. As soon as that came before the board, it was all over, out. What is totally unacceptable, is one thing that is totally unacceptable to the American public, and that is lying. And I give you this list because the great temptation for most of us when they're there with the microphones, you know, and the politicians are standing over there looking at us and the parents and teachers are there is to kind of bend it a little. Just kind of bend it a little. The evidence is don't ever do it. In fact, it's almost to the point that confession is not only good for the soul, but it's darn good issue management. There's something about saying we screwed up, or I really have concern for those people, and we're going to look into this, that really indeed does win people's support. Because you'll still hear all the popping of mouths. They'll say all these things. But deep down inside, they say, hey, you know, that's another person just like me. And that's powerful stuff. Whenever we can get the folks who disagree with education to admit that you and I are at least human, you'll have to admit that's really kind of winning, right? Given who our opponents very often are today. Well, that's some things I can tell you about our experience in this field. I would urge you to consider setting up some kind of a method for anticipating issues. And I'll tell you this, once you get into it, it'll also lead you to lots of other things, and you'll also stop some issues from happening. One other point, I said that there were some good sides to issues, and that if you anticipated them, you could plug them in. Sometimes we have topics that we would give our eye teeth to get the public to pay attention to, and they just won't. And every once in a while, along comes an issue that's going to lead right into that subject. And if you're anticipating the issue, sometimes we want to be the issue creators. In other words, this time, boy, you you fan the flames, you throw gas on it. What can we do to really get it to be an issue? And suddenly, it's out there in front of the public. Now, it takes some skill to do that. There's no question about it. But in the healthcare field, for example, we do this with regularity. With regularity. We let those issues come up and force people to dig into it. The daycare issue rose out of the accusations of sexual mistreatment of children in California and New Jersey. Several of us who work for clients that are concerned about that had spent years trying to get America to pay attention, and they wouldn't do it. Do you think we'd even be talking about surrogate motherhood and so forth if this hadn't become a big deal? It would still be a closet issue. Well, hopefully you won't have to deal with any like that. But there is a time, if you know what the issues are, if you know whether they're latent, emerging, or what, if you've got a database on them, that then you may want to shove them out there in order to get your situation in front of the people. Before you do that, usually you want to have a fairly good scenario of how it's all going to turn out and all your fallbacks and all your campaign put together, but that's all right. We're used to doing that. Well, that's what I know. What can I answer for you or straighten out or what I didn't explain properly or what? I was going to ask all of you what issues, you know, you were facing. Let me just do that. Let me just take a couple minutes. Let's talk about crises. That's more fun. Yes.
Can I have one question? This
is sure. Sure.
In 30 seconds, what were the 5 steps of advice you gave Gary Hart?
You know, I'm not even sure. Well, yeah, I'm not even sure I can remember now. I remember one of the way down the list ones was that. We had Gary say something to the effect, and there was a lead into this that made it much more powerful, but he said, people say, you know, that this has something to do with my presidency. He says, well, let's examine the record. And then he says, you know, well, let's see, there was FDR, and, you know, and there was JFK, and he just ticked off the names of all the presidents who have been involved in that kind of thing. And we had set up the list so that all of the leading critics who had gotten in on it had their favorite kind of jabbed. And generally that has them go away. What else did we have them do? He was having some problems at that time. Some people were saying that he was kind of slow and uncreative, you know. And we had some funny phraseology around that, which I can't remember. I'm sorry, we do enough of this that they were pretty good, and we knew they would have worked. Well, the other thing that we urged him to do was to use that, again, to make an issue. And the issue was, one of the things he said, there's no way Hart was ever going to win Florida. It was a dead issue for him. And so we had him say, you know, doesn't that beat all Americans? Here we have Miami, the drug import capital of America. Every bank in town has been indicted for laundering drug money, and all the Miami Herald can think to do with its reporters is park them in bushes in Georgetown. Pretty effective. And when he finally did attack the press, as you may know, the study showed that about 75% of Americans said that's right. They ought to do something. And we had some jokes about bushes and stuff like that. It was well, and that was very pertinent, of course. We used the word Bush for a very, very important purpose. The thought was that Hart might emerge as the candidate, and you know that's what they were. They were hiding in hiding in the shrubs, so that was not total honesty. But it's okay to call shrubs bushes, I think. So we did. Tell me, I should carry that list around with me. It was a pretty good list. But we've done this, you know, so many times that I just can't remember what they were. By the way, humor is a wonderful tool if you can use it. But boy, you got to have just the right situation, and you really got to have some practice in doing it, because it can also come right back in your face. But our model for that, you know, was Grover Cleveland, and that situation where Cleveland, you remember, had a child out of wedlock between his first and second terms, and they taunted him, and they said to try and defeat him, they said, I can't remember what this person's name was, Joe, let's say it was. Well, let's see if I can even remember the rhyme. Something about, Ma, where's my pa? Going to the White House, ha, ha, ha. That was the way he dealt with having an illegitimate child between his terms, which were separated by a period when he lost. And it just completely did in the opposition, you know. Well, tell me some crises that you're dealing with. This might be helpful. You got a crisis or a question? Is that a crisis or just a question? Okay.
Is there a danger that the issue anticipation team will bring something to light which might have otherwise died of natural death? Mm. Three people in the community that are concerned that they're vociferous. And so by identifying that and...
And doing anything about it.
Throwing gasoline. Yep.
Oh, absolutely. Please understand, the issue anticipation team is a very in-house group. This is the CIA, if you will, okay? And I mean, they talk to you, you talk to them. This is all in-house intelligence. Whether we ever do anything to dignify it out there is another question. But supposing you found these three people, you would then face this question. Should we now go in some way and set up a way that either kind of accidentally or very directly, depending on who they are, we can talk to these folks and see if we can diffuse that issue? Or would that, in fact, encourage them and, as you point out, make an issue or help make one where there wasn't one? Clearly, that kind of judgment has to be involved at every step of the way. The difference is, this way, at least you know who the three are. You can get a kind of a fix on whether or not their ability to build this into a major issue exists, and you have the choice of doing something about it. The option is not to know that those three are out there, and by the time you hear about it, it's 300 or 3,000. But absolutely. In fact, I said earlier that the issues come from operational failures. Another place that the second category, the second highest category of crises after operational failure, come from inept responses that we make when we are criticized. And those two aren't all that far apart. Some of you have heard me say that when during the 60s and 70s, when all those picketers out there were our clients, we used to have a very standard technique. We would find a big, juicy target, a government agency or a big corporation or some other institution. Fortunately, we weren't after the schools in those days. In fact, most of the picketers were school workers and the causes I worked on. But in any event, we'd find this juicy target, and we'd think up the sexiest accusation we could, and we'd run in and hit them with it, and then we could go on vacation for 2-3 weeks. Because they would spend 2-3 weeks, you know, just being outraged, and every day they'd be saying, we didn't do it, and they would take our little nothing issue, and by the time they were done with it, it was a big flaming controversy. And then we'd come back from vacation and kind of zap them again and go off, you know, and they'd spend 3 more weeks. Their dignity was offended. No, my goodness gracious. So you've hit on a good point. But I'm talking now about real management, real administration, finding out what's going on and dealing with it inside without going external at all to give anybody a chance. And, you know, that's an interesting question. Think of the zealots in your community. And by the way, the number of issues that come from zealots, believe it or not, isn't as large as it seems. It's just that it's so loud that it seems that they're really doing it. Most issues start out with honest-to-goodness people who just think something or discover something. And how we treat them is then critical. And too often we do treat them like commie pinkos. We recently did a study of the nuclear power situation in this country. One of our clients started the anti-nuclear movement, and another client 15 years later built the world's largest nuclear plant down in Arizona, so we've been on both sides of the fence. And when we studied it, what has brought the nuclear industry to its knees is that this was their scenario. When the first critics stood up, first they said, listen, Junior, just leave the running of the utilities to us. What do you know about it? Then when that didn't work, they said, you know, I think these people are trying to damage our economy. They're commie pinkos. See? And then when that didn't work, they said, let the bastards freeze in the dark. Well, every time they said that, these little nuclear cells would grow 10 times, 100 times. Then they'd say something else 1,000 times. First thing you know, an issue that probably could have been dealt with was such a major national issue that, as you know, it has now pretty much brought the nuclear industry to a standstill. And the plant in Long Island is not going to open, and the one in my backyard in Seabrook probably isn't either. And I'm not sure that anybody's benefiting from all of that. That's what I mean by running the country on crisis.
This is not an issue, but a question. Issue anticipation team, size?
No, and they range all over the place. I think it's more judged by just the basics of group dynamics than by anything else. But the one thing I would allow to overrule good committee work, if you will, is the number of viewpoints that you really feel you need to get in there. I mean, I wouldn't mind having a larger than normal team if it enabled me to get some really interesting, you know, viewpoints of folks who do things a little differently. If you have someone, certainly if your system has an adult education program and an outreach, I would certainly probably want someone from that on the team because they're out there dealing with the adults more than say a teacher in a classroom. But I know them all the way from 6 to probably, I guess 20 is probably the most. And by the way, I'm not talking about spending any money on this whatsoever, zero. You know, at the end of the school year, every so often, throw them a shindig, buy them a meal or something. If this works, people will want to be on this committee. People will fight to be on this team.
A lot of the issues are going to be religiously based. Then what kind of team might you put together for our school system?
Well, see, now that gets back to the earlier question. Maybe we outside this room, we shouldn't talk about the fact that they're religiously based, and we should go on treating them objectively and just know that what's really motivating to people who get involved is some kind of a religious conviction of their own. And so I don't know but that's kind of interesting. We have thought of getting some of the external people on the team or advisors to the team to be maybe folks with different religious viewpoints in the community. So far we haven't done that though because we're afraid we're going to identify those as religious issues. And it's really tough. It's really tough if you say they're religious. But if you know any of the studies that have been done, and we've done some of them ourselves, on, for example, who's pro-choice, who's pro-life, who's feeling a certain way about a curriculum, wants to ban books and so forth, who feels that people ought to be able to do it. Those are two very distinct types of groups. And whether you or I like it or not, the profile is very similar in those groups. The pro-life people are very similar to the banned books people, and I'm just picking those two right off the top of my head. They tend to be high school education or less. They tend to be, we probably know all this, they tend to have lower incomes. They tend to be people who often, the leaders, often in some early stage of their lives, quite psychologically predictable, were involved in some situation which just embarrassed them to tears, generally around the subject on which they are now campaigning. On the other hand, the pro-choice people, the people who think you ought to be able to read anything you want, tend to be college graduates, tend to have a professional or executive positions, tend to have more money. Now, see, if you want to count all those numbers, that's not necessarily a good count if it ever comes down to a vote, because there's more of the folks who want to ban the books than there are those who maybe don't. The good part is, of course, that most Americans, you know, will give an opinion about it, but they won't do anything about it. And so the opinion leaders are clearly on the side of those who don't want to ban the books. Any other questions?
One more.
Are there any racial issues and gang issues too far along for an anticipation team?
Yeah, the gang issue are clearly hot issues. And the thing about the gang issue is that the gang issue isn't an issue. The gang issue is a crisis that really is not involving an issue. The issue that's going to come out of gangs, interestingly enough, is going to pit people who want to do something about gangs against our old ally, the ACLU, and other defenders of civil liberties. Because, as always, the approach is, you know, sweep them off the streets, and there our good friends who defend us on other things are going to have to say, wait a minute, they have their rights. We've dealt with gangs in about 4 cities. And it's a crisis. In fact, it is a crisis, however, that has tremendous opportunity and very little political will to deal with it. The political will is all to get the army and just march them out. The opportunity, for crying out loud, is to really get the town to take a look at the subculture, at crime, at all those issues, including what are we doing with our schools, as a unified subject, and really hit it hard. In a couple of smaller communities where mayors or city council people or a school superintendent in one case have been willing to do that, the community really comes together. I mean, this is the Second World War all over again. There's nobody who's in favor of gangs, including, as you know, a lot of the gang members who were coerced into it, and their parents usually think it's awful. And here it is defeating us. I mean, it's just... You know, we have more or less taken the position that there aren't any racial issues, because as soon as you treat any issue as racial, you just lost. It is totally and absolutely unmanageable. And when we deal with those, we try never even to mention that. And we do deal with a large number of these. We have a lot of clients in the Southwest and clients in Northeastern and Midwest cities, so we get the Hispanic, the black issue pretty continuously. And as soon as you let those words be used, and even if the other side is using them, don't use them. Let them use them, but you don't use them. You keep talking in terms of persons and just totally ignore that thing. That's what we've found anyway.
Pat, thank you very much.